At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to take your finance and investment questions and share their unbiased answers. This is InvestTalk, independent thinking, shared success. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. This is a special Best of Caller Questions InvestTalk compilation program. Remember, the InvestTalk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART. 888-99-CHART. They will be played and answered on an upcoming InvestTalk podcast.
Welcome to InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. We try to bring you useful information and answer any questions you might have, as long as they're financial. 888-99-CHART is our number, 888-992-4278.
Hi, Steve and Justin. This is Kevin calling from Southern California. I have a question about bonds. If I were holding some longer-term bonds, whether they be treasuries or corporate bonds, and when interest rates start going back down, how do you decide whether or not to, assuming that the bond value increases, how do you decide when to sell the bond? Like, how much would it need to increase versus holding on to the bond to maturity and just collecting the coupon? Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out when interest rates start falling, if it's better to sell the bond and use that towards something else, or hold, keep a hold on to it. Look forward to hearing your advice on the show. Thank you, as always.
Okay, that's a good question. First of all, you probably have to ask yourself, well, why did you buy the bond? Did you buy it for the yield that it pays? You know, 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever it pays, is that why you bought it? Or did you buy it with the thought that it's going to appreciate because interest rates will come back down eventually? Well, the Fed will lower rates eventually. Therefore, I'll have capital gains in the value of the bonds. So if you're telling me that you bought it because you're looking for the capital gains for the bonds and you want to sell it at their best price, and that's a much more difficult question to answer, because who knows how low the bonds will go. Part of our main focus point today is talking about where the interest rates are going to go by the Fed, and they feel that the interest rates are going to start rolling over downward by the end of the year. This is from Morningstar, this article. I think the Fed will start lowering them by the end of the year because inflation will be under much more control. Now, how low will they get? They are predicting that it'll be in about the 3% range. Okay, and the inflation rate will be less than the target rate of 2% by the Fed. I don't know if I'm that optimistic, but you would base that on where you think interest rates are going to go. What is their maximum fall? They're not likely to go back to zero. That's not likely. But will they go to 3%? That's very possible. At some point, they can easily go there. Okay, and that may be when you would sell your bonds. But that's a harder question. It's much more difficult. You can use a chart of the bond price. And when it starts to flatten out, if interest rates start to go down, when it starts to flatten out, then maybe take your profits, as the price goes up in value, as interest rates go down in value. All right, interest rates go down. Good question, though.
Do you have questions about FDIC security, mortgages, money market funds, losses to your retirement plans? Give us a call today, 888-99-CHART.
Hi, how are you doing? My name is Mike. I'm from Ohio. I've been listening for some time. I appreciate everything you guys do, first off. Thank you for the program. I had maybe an oversimplified question here, but I have heard it said that the Fed raises rates only so that they can lower rates, and vice versa. So they raise rates to lower them, and then they lower rates to raise them, et cetera. It's all a balancing act. It's all meant to drive that monetary policy, surrounding inflation controls and all of that. And I've also heard it stated that the reason that inflation has gotten so out of control is because the Fed also artificially suppressed or held the interest rates at a very low or zero rate for so long. And so I guess my question boils down to this. If the Fed raising rates is what they've done to kind of rein in inflation, and that seems to be working based on the lowering prices, and they are now thinking about backing off of doing further rate hikes, am I wrong to think that it would be a good idea to just hold them where they're at and not pivot to immediately cutting them? I mean, why would they raise them only to stop raising them just to cut them? What am I missing here? Thanks.
The thing that you're missing, but in a sense you are correct, the Fed raises rates only to lower them later. What you're missing is what are the reasons they're doing it. The reasons they raise rates is to slow down the economy, and the reason why they want to slow down the economy is they think that that would reduce inflation. Well, why would it reduce inflation? Because everybody there's a lot of millions of people out of work, don't have money to buy things, and all of a sudden corporate America can't raise their prices anymore because they're trying to get sales, and to do so they got to kind of either keep the price of their things at where they are or lower them. So in a sense, the Fed raises rates and lowers rates because they want to. But there's always that underlying reason, and that is they're trying to control inflation. So they've been raising rates to slow the economy, because when the economy gets hot, usually inflation gets out of control. Well, but that's not the only reason inflation gets out of control, because the economy gets hot. Inflation also gets out of control because of government overspending or printing too much money. The more money they print, the less value it has. Think about this. If you have $1 million and things cost $1 million and that's what you live by, then next year you have $2 million. Does that make the first million that you had worth less money? In other words, does inflation take it? What if you had $10 million? What if you could print all the money you wanted and you said, gee, I think I'm going to print $100 million, and you started with one. Wouldn't that make the money worth less? Because the cost of goods to make the things you buy, they don't go up that fast. They might go up fast because they think, well, gee, the money, I'm going to raise prices because you got plenty of money. I'm going to keep raising prices. That's what inflation does. Okay? So if you print too much money and put it in the system, it makes everything overvalued. Raises prices, including the stock market, by the way, makes everything expensive. That's called inflation. It's inflationary to print money. That's what we're dealing with. And the government has printed so much money since COVID alone. They already were printing a bunch of money. Now they printed more. Good question. Thanks for the call, Jason. You can call right now and be part of the program. Let's hear about what your talking point is. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278, and you can get through right now.
Justin Klein talks about the KPP Financial Premium Newsletter.
I want to remind you that this is a time where you probably need some guidance, and you're tuning in to try to get our view of the markets. And we only have an hour here, and sometimes the way I distill each day can be maybe not enough time. And so our premium newsletter is a great tool for especially newer investors trying to learn some things.
The KPP Financial Premium Newsletter comes to your mailbox every Saturday.
Learn how to analyze the market, learn what the economic numbers mean, learn how to manage a portfolio, maybe get an idea of what are good companies to be at least looking at. Maybe you don't buy it today, but you should always have a watch list of companies that, hey, these are interesting, these have good businesses. And if they get the right price, maybe I should buy them. So our newsletter is a great tool for that.
Subscribe anytime at investtalk.com.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Paul, San Francisco, wants to talk about short selling. Hi, Paul.
Yes, I listen to KDOW. I'm up here in the Bay Area, and one of the analysts on the radio station says that short selling is a good thing to do, but I think it's much more risky than long buying. But does anyone know, is it possible to know, is more money made short selling or a loss or won or even? It's not even.
Buying long has been traditionally the way to make money in the market, and it's much more reliable than short selling. For me, short selling is only a hedge for everybody else. Short selling means you predict whatever you're investing in, you're selling short in, it's usually stocks. You think it's going to go down in value, and if you sell the stock short, if it does go down in value, you make money on the upside. That's short selling. Usually people buy long, meaning they buy the stock and hope it goes up. It's called buying long, selling short or buying long. Buying long, Paul, has been the traditional way most people make money because the market has an upside bias over 100 years. The bias of the stock market is to the upside. So selling short is much riskier than buying long. Plus, when you're buying long, you're betting that the company, you buy companies that grow and their sales and grow their profits. That's what you're looking for. And the odds of them going up is much stronger than the odds of a company that you think is going to go down will go down. It's just, so buying long is the best way to do it. Paul, appreciate the call. Good question.
Got a question for Steve or Justin? You're the best person to ask it at 888-99-CHART. Now's the best time.
Hey, Steve and Justin, John here from Lakeland, Florida. I have a handful of stocks from 2021 that at this point I've lost all optimism for them to incline back to at least where I bought them. And this is before I discovered the stop-loss option. Anyways, my question is that, is it better to take a loss and sell the stock before it goes to zero, or is it better to allow the stock to go to zero, or does it really matter either way? Just trying to figure out the best way to recoup as much of my losses on these stocks as possible. I hope it made some sense here. Look forward to hearing your insight. Appreciate you guys.
Well, this is pretty simple. This is a very common habit of new investors is you're down and you just hold hoping and praying. And I say two things. Hope is not a strategy. Hope is not a strategy. Just because it's down doesn't mean it has to come back. Remember this. The majority of public companies that have been public, listed on the NYSE, listed on major exchanges, they're gone. The majority of them are gone because their business fails. And doesn't mean, you know, you're not immune to that, buying companies that fail, that you're wrong about. It's natural to be wrong. No one is going to be right 100% of the time. Nobody, even the best investors in the world. So understand that. Is it better to wait for it to go to zero? Absolutely not. And it's worth nothing. At least it's worth something today. And then the second part is opportunity cost. You have to be, I'd say, greedy with your capital. Understand that. Your opportunity cost is always, do I own this, continue to own this today, or do I put it in something else that will likely do better going forward? It's not about what happened in the past. That's what we call a sunk cost. You've lost that. Is this asset still the best use of that capital, or should you sell it and buy something else? And when you're down that much, it means you're wrong, and you have to admit you're wrong, and you move on, and you buy something else. So absolutely, you sell it, you move on, as long as you can admit you're wrong and you realize that, hey, I thought it was in this way, and I mean, I thought that their business was going to do better, or I thought their innovation was going to hit in a bigger way. Whatever it is, you were probably wrong. Or maybe you bought it too expensive, and it probably should never been there, and maybe we'll never get there again. I think of Zoom. Zoom's a great example. Zoom, everyone got caught up in the hype. I think of NVIDIA like that today. You know, the hype of work from home and everyone's going to be on Zoom, and people didn't realize that, you know, video conference software is not exactly innovative, and there's a lot of them out there, and they're all pretty much do the same thing. And Zoom peaked at nearly $600 per share, and now it's at $66 per share. All those people that bought it, you know, hundreds of dollars per share, they were wrong. They were wrong at the price that they paid. Zoom's still a fine company. I believe it's profitable. Is it? Yeah, it's profitable. But was it ever worth $500, $600? No. So sometimes you get caught up in the hype, and that's something common for new investors. Okay, so sell it and move on.
You're listening to Invest Talk, everybody. I'm Steve Peasley. We want to answer your questions. Our listener line number is always ready for you. 888-99-CHART. Beginning our experience, we're here to answer your questions.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Let's go talk to Taylor in Minneapolis, and he has a portfolio management question.
Hey, Justin. Yeah, I've got a question about just evaluating your own personal portfolio. I know that the Dow is only made up of 30 stocks, and the S&P 500 is made up of the top 500. When comparing my portfolio to the S&P 500 over the last 6 months, I've only made a measly 2% on my portfolio, and the S&P 500 is up 14%. So I'm just curious to know if there's a better way to evaluate my personal portfolio or how you go about doing that.
Yeah, hey, this is Luke here. That's a great question, because I think, you know, one of the things people struggle with is benchmarking their portfolio. Part of that is understanding what makes up those benchmarks. So the S&P 500 is actually not the top 500 companies in the U.S. market, but just companies that are selected from the Standards and Poor's Committee. And so that's how they make up that benchmark. So if you take a look at the S&P 7, for example, the seven handful of names this year, it's up like upwards of 20%. But if you take a look at the other 493, it's only up about 3% this year. And that's really indicative of the overall market. So, you know, if you're a look about... It's called breadth. Yeah. If you're taking a look at, you know, how you should benchmark your portfolio, if you have a diversified you know, portfolio of U.S. equities, for example, then you want to find a diversified U.S. index. The Russell 3000 is a great one. It takes a look at the top 3,000 companies, and it gives you a more accurate representation, you know, of what is happening in the U.S. market.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, because at any given time, there's a what is called style drift. And especially in those market cap weighted indices like the S&P 500. And it basically means that the larger names, they have a bigger weight. So if for right now, the tech industry is the highest weighting within the S&P, because they just tend to be valued the highest. But that isn't always the case, right? There've been periods where, you know, kind of pre 2008, the oil sector, Exxon was the largest holding within the S&P. And so it varies. And so does that mean that you want to benchmark something where maybe you're way underweight tech? And should you be benchmarking towards an index that's overweight tech? Probably not. You want something that's a lot broader. And that's, I agree with Luke, you know, something like the Russell 3000. That's why I look at the NYSE, for example. That's 2,500 different names. That's going to give you a much better representation. Ideally, you probably want you want to create your own benchmark if you can, probably with your sector weightings, right? So there's your understanding, are your energy stocks outperforming the energy stocks within that sector, within the market? Are your industrial stocks outperforming the industrial stocks within the market? That's the way I would probably look at it, more than the portfolio in aggregate. So it's definitely difficult to benchmark, because you want to be comparing apples to apples. And by nature, all portfolios are just a little bit different.
This is Invest Talk, made possible by KPP Financial, where they describe their services as independent thinking, shared success. And this philosophy is why KPP Financial can be of great value to investors. KPP principals Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are committed to unbiased guidance. They don't upsell clients into expensive and questionable investments. Instead, Steve and Justin provide honest opinions and proven strategies based on the individual's current portfolio and risk tolerance. Working with KPP Financial, you can be assured of consistent dedication toward the goal of helping you achieve financial freedom. You can get things started with a phone call or a simple message through investtalk.com. The Invest Talk radio and podcast continues now. The phone lines are open. Call with your questions. 888-99-CHART.
Hi, my name's Sam. I'm a new listener. I have a question about whole life insurance policies. I have one of those for all five of my kids, and I've got one for myself and my wife. And putting away about 35 to 40% of the savings, my monthly amount of savings, I put about 30 to 40% of that into these very secure, well, at least I think they're secure, policies. And I intend to pay them for the next, you know, 20, 25 years. I'm 32. I've had them since I was 24. And I'm just wondering, I have the option to stop paying them. And then they'll still last, and they've been paid up enough, so there won't be, you know, they won't lapse or anything like that. And I'm just wondering if I should stop paying those and direct that 30% towards something else. Thank you.
Well, I would. There's whole life, universal life, term life. Life insurance is supposed to be for life insurance. Insurance companies like to say, well, no, life insurance is an investment. And they use whole life and universal life as proof that it's an investment. Is it an investment? Yes. But I don't think it's a very efficient investment. If you need life insurance, buy term life. That's for a certain amount over a certain period of time. I would not put more money into the whole life. I would put that money into an account, a joint account, me and my wife, or if you're not maxing out your 401k, open up a IRA to get some tax benefits out of that, and then invest that money. You'll find that if you do the math and do it over a long period of time, you'll probably have more money investing on your own than if you would have kept putting it in the whole life, universal life. Remember, you got to pay commissions for those things. They're expensive to maintain and keep, meaning there's high costs. You can call right now and be part of the program. Let's hear about what your talking point is. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278, and you can get through right now.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight, the debit card and money app made for families. If you are a parent, have you noticed that as you are online, you may often see ads for various parenting hacks. In other words, quick solutions to tricky problems. Some hacks may be good ideas, others maybe not. Well, if you are committed to raising children that are made smarter and stronger by learning about financial responsibility, I encourage you to check out Greenlight. You see, as a debit card and money app made for families, Greenlight gives kids and teens an easy and fun way to gain financial literacy while providing peace of mind for parents. With Greenlight, you can send instant money transfers, automate your kids' allowance, and keep an eye on their spending with real-time notifications. Meanwhile, your kids can begin their journey towards financial autonomy by learning how to save, invest, and spend wisely. The Greenlight app includes a chores feature, so you can set up recurring or one-time tasks that are customized to your family's needs, and then reward your young ones for a job well done. Since 2017, Greenlight has helped more than 6 million parents and kids manage their finances. In fact, with Greenlight tools, families can even learn to invest together. Sign up today for Greenlight, the debit card and money app made for families, and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/investtalk. That's greenlight.com/investtalk to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/investtalk.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Hey, Steve or Justin, you guys always say that you should never have one stock be more than 5% of your portfolio. When you say 5% of your portfolio, do you mean of just your stock portfolio, or does that count like your cash and retirement account as well? Is it just your stock portfolio, that everything to get it, that it shouldn't be more than 5% of? Thank you. I'll listen on the podcast.
I definitely think it's more of your broad investment assets. So if you have an IRA and a 401k, then you can combine those together, for example. I think you put cash separately, and that's kind of its own bucket for emergencies. What do you think, Luke?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't know if I would separate cash. I consider that a part of my asset base as well. But, you know, when you think about the risks that you're taking on with any individual investment, you have to have it in the lens of what your overall allocation, right? So if a client comes to us and wants to manage their assets, we have to see everything they have so that you can appropriately diversify, appropriately control for those risks. So, yeah, I think I agree. It's more of a broad view.
Yeah, because it's... You know, if you have a small portfolio, that's 10% of your total assets. You know, if it's 20% in one name, you know, overall you're broadly diversified because you have other assets elsewhere. So, yeah, it's definitely out of your overall asset base. Right?
Hey guys, I have a daughter. She's almost 1 year old, and I'm looking to start saving money for her. And I'm just wondering what the best options that would be. I've heard you guys talk about 529 plans before. I'm just wondering if I go that route. You could just give like a 30-second overview of what that entails. And I think I've heard on the program before that you can actually buy a 529 plan from any state. You don't have to actually live in that state. And if that's the case, could you just go over one or two options, which ones would be the best state to go with? Thanks. Love what you guys do. Appreciate it.
Okay. 529 program is an educational program that put away money for whomever you want to use for educational purposes. And it has to be accredited colleges only. It can't be, you know, beauty school or truck driver school. It has to be an accredited college. So that's the restriction you have. And you're limited. And each state, or not all states have them, but most do, have 529 programs because they are state sponsored. Okay, so if you live in one state, you don't have to, as he said, buy the 529 in that state. You can go buy it in any other state you want to. What's the benefit? And the benefit is it grows tax-free. The 529s grow tax-free. You don't ever have to pay capital gains on anything in there. It's like an IRA. Do you have to take it out? No. You don't, and you can transfer it to another child or an adult or whatever as the beneficiary. So if one child doesn't want to go and you have a second child and they do, you can transfer it to the second child. Long time ago, I did a quick survey of this, and I found that one of the better states was Florida, and I think one of the Midwest states, like Illinois or one of those states, I don't remember, were also good, but you have to do some research because each state can change the rules in that state. You know, many of the 529s, now some states restrict you to certain investments. Most of them restrict you to mutual funds, but some states say, well, as the child gets closer to 18, you have to be more conservative. I mean, that makes no sense to me. You know, why a state should control anything about your investments. I don't buy that, but... So I would find the state with the least restrictions and go with that company, restrictions on your investments. And I would go with, you know, some speculative indexes or mutual funds, whatever they provide. Good call. Thank you for the call. Appreciate that.
This is InvestTalk, made possible by KPP Financial, where principals and InvestTalk hosts Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are independent financial advisors. For clients, they are fiduciaries. Steve and Justin have a duty and a commitment to always place the interests of their clients ahead of the firm. This is different from the way many other organizations operate. And one way you can realize the benefit of an association with KPP Financial is to know that KPP practices parallel investing. This means that the personal investment accounts of KPP principals participate with client investments at equal prices and percentages. It's an important difference. You can learn more anytime at investtalk.com or reach out to Steve Peasley and Justin Klein by emailing or calling their Irvine, California office. The InvestTalk radio and podcast continues now. The phone lines are open. Call with questions, 888-99-CHART.
Great show, love it, and appreciate all that you do for us. I'm trying to find out if there's any truth to something that I've heard, and I'll try to explain it as an example. If I had 10 shares of Apple for a year, and in a year and a half I add another share, and let's say now I have 11 shares, are the 10 original shares still long-term gains? I had also heard that once you add to your position, that timing starts over. So just interested in understanding how that works. Appreciate it, and thanks again.
Very simple. It's called share lots. No, if you buy more shares of a position, it doesn't reset your timing of those original shares you purchased. So you can buy one share every week forever, but those original 10 shares that you bought are still long-term because you bought them on that particular date over a year ago. So no, it does not reset your timing of any other shares that you own. There's different share lots. Now, if you want to sell a position and you want to specify share lots, there's some settings typically within your brokerage account that you can change it to first in, first out or last in, first out. There are some different rules that can be set depending on your broker. So check with that. And if you want to be sure, maybe call up your broker and say, hey, I just want to sell these lots so that I make sure that they are long term or I'm getting rid of the short term or whatever, whatever your strategy is. So no, it does not reset if you buy more shares.
Hi, Steve and Justin. I've got a question for you. This is Craig from the mountains outside Seattle. I am cash flowing a shop on my property that's going to cost about $150,000. I've already got about 80 of it cash flowed without having to cash anything out, but I intended to cash out investments for it anyway. So my question is, I've got about $70,000 in RSUs through my work, and I've also got about $300,000 in a brokerage account. My thought is to use the RSUs first, since they're already part of my adjusted gross income and parts have already been pulled out for taxes. I just want to know if that's the right approach. It should cover the rest of the build without having to touch my brokerage. So just wondered your thoughts on that and if I'm thinking the right way or if I'm missing something. Thanks so much.
Well, I'm not an accountant, but it sounds the best way to me. You want to use those funds that probably have already been taxed. And you said the RSUs, you've already paid taxes on that, so you don't have to worry about paying more money out of your pocket to cash in the RSU, restricted stocks. So, what your other solution was to be take out of your brokerage account. I'm not for that because you probably have capital gains. But again, that's why I say talk to your accountant. Do you have capital gains taxes that you would have to take or continue to take losses? If you can take losses, okay, and might be advisable to take some losses to apply to future capital gains. If you don't have losses, then maybe not. And if the restricted stocks, what kind of company do you work for? Is it growing? How strong is it? Those kind of questions need to be answered. And it's hard to answer that since I don't know any of those facts. But on the surface, it sounds like the smart thing to do. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Do you have questions about FDIC security, mortgages, money market funds, losses to your retirement plans? Give us a call today, 888-99-CHART.
Now let's pivot back to the InvestTalk voice bank. From the number that never closes, it's 888-99-CHART. And this question came in from Florida.
I am putting money into my Roth on a weekly basis to maximize my Roth because I can't do it all in one drop at the beginning of the year. what's the best way to invest into stocks or ETFs when you can't buy a large block of a stock at a given time? So you're slowly putting into the market on a weekly basis. Do you just pick stocks that you think are going to do well and dollar cost average over the entire year and then adjust the strategy as needed? Or is it best to just kind of blindly invest into these ETFs or index funds? Thanks. I look forward to hearing the answer.
Either way, you're doing dollar cost averaging, but you are going to pick a strategy that works for you. There's no right answer to what strategy is best for everybody because of risk tolerance levels, expertise, discipline, etc. Clearly, the only way to do better than the market is to not invest in the market, invest in individual positions. But there's risk there, and you have to know what you're doing in order to put the odds in your favor. And that's what we try to do on the show, obviously. If you don't have the time and the expertise and the discipline, then you probably just want to index. Especially if you're a small investor, right? Indexing, the cost of indexing is very small because you're talking about a small dollar amount. When you get to six figures plus, then you know the cost of indexing, cost of just having funds in general, becomes a lot higher, and then suddenly individual stocks and bonds might make sense. But you have to still have the discipline or then the expertise and the time and the data. So it's really about first figuring out that strategy and then dollar cost averaging towards that strategy. Sounds like you're a new investor, so maybe just indexing makes sense for now, but over time, maybe that could change.
Hi, Steve or Justin. My name's Eric, and I've been listening to your show for about a year now, and I've really learned a lot. I thank you for that. And I was wondering if sometime on the program you could talk a little bit about SPACs or special purpose acquisition companies. I guess specifically what I'm wondering is how do these compare to like a traditional IPO as far as are they more risky, less risky? And I know you've talked in the past about not investing in an IPO until it's been out for at least 6 months for the insiders to kind of get out and prices to regulate or whatever. Do you have any kind of general guidelines for companies that become public through the SPAC? Thank you, and I'll listen for your answer.
Great question. Now, SPAC stands for Special Purpose Acquisition Company. What it does is it raises capital, maybe a few billion dollars, and the idea is to go out and buy another company, buy an actual company. The SPAC doesn't have initially any company in it. It's just an asset with cash. And then they use that cash to go make an acquisition. And oftentimes the price of that SPAC will pop dramatically. And this all has to do, it's financial engineering. They're limiting the supply of shares that are out there, right? Because the owners of that SPAC, owners of the shares, typically are closely held. So when the supply of shares are very, very low and they go make an acquisition and he wants to buy into that acquisition, they're chasing after a very select few number of shares, and that really explodes the value of that SPAC. So, you know, if you want to play that game, that financial engineering game that a SPAC does, then that's fine. But it's also very risky. They might make a poor acquisition. They may not keep as many shares held to the vest as they had hoped. There are a lot of risks to it. But it's definitely not an investment vehicle. It's a speculative vehicle only.
Hey, guys. This is Peter from Columbus. Thanks for the show. I love it. I just had a quick question about options. So I've been trading options for about the last few months, and it's been going well for me. But I was just curious, I understand the concept of it pretty well, but as far as the time to expiration and things like that, and then the possibility of profit, does the length of time itself actually impact it? Now, I understand that there's, you know, the expiration and strikes and all that stuff, but let's say I were to make a call, I were to buy an option for a week or an option for 45 days with the same strike price. Would that impact the potential profit that I could make outside of just the time to expiration, or how does that formula kind of work? Hopefully I can get this answered. Really appreciate it. Thanks, guys. Love the show.
Great question. And
The fact that you asked me that question makes me worried that you're actually trading options, because you should know this is the basics of options. So when you're buying an option, you likely want to go farther out, meaning, you know, yes, your payoff could be higher or will be higher if you buy a shorter dated option, say a week or a month out, because the time value that you're paying for is very small relative to longer dated options, maybe 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, maybe even a year out. You're paying a much bigger premium for that option because you're buying a lot of time. And the odds are you're going to need that time. Now, you certainly could get a quick payoff and the stock might move rather quickly on you and you're going to get a big return. That's certainly possible. But when you buy more time, it gives you more time for your bet to eventually pay off. If you buy a week option, a month option, right, where it expires relatively quickly, you're up against the clock. You're already on the clock for that to play out. And if it doesn't, you could lose all of your money rather quickly. So I always say, if you're going to buy options, you want to be going further out in the expiration scale. And if you're selling options, whether that's a call or a put, you want to be shorter. You want to get that time value decay to be happening rather quickly. So it depends on which side of the ledger you're on, whether you're a buyer option or a seller of options, but that's kind of how they work.
Now, if you have a question about a stock or an IRA, college savings plan, well, maybe buying a house, mortgages, reverse mortgages, we're here for you. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Hello, Steve and Justin. This is Jay Clark calling from Chicago again. Just had a question about commodities in general. You see the gold mini shares, you see the gold directions, the 3x leverage, you know, all type of different types of commodity holdings. Just wanted you to explain, you know, the differences between those different type of commodity holdings and what they mean to us as investors. Hope to hear it on the show. Thank you.
All right. Well, commodities can be broken up in a lot of different ways. You have your energy commodities, right? Your oil, coal, natural gas. You have your soft commodities. You're talking about sugar, grain, corn, etc. You also have your precious metal commodities, your gold, your silver, your platinum, etc. So they all have very different use cases, very different properties, and they act very different in their price action in the marketplace. When you have a tough economic environment like right now, you're going to see the energy commodities do much worse and the precious metal commodities do much better. Now, you can invest in ETFs that track particular prices of those different commodities or a basket of commodities. That's one way to gain access. You can also own the individual companies who mine, produce those type of commodities, right? Or you can buy an ETF that owns a lot of the companies and you get broad diversification, like a GDX owns a bunch of gold miners, or you can invest in ETFs that are leveraged, and then that is a speculative vehicle to help capitalize on the movement of the underlying commodity or the shares of the companies who produce that underlying commodity. So all of them have different risk factors. I think the lowest risk is going to be the actual commodity, because it's a direct link. A little bit higher risk would be investing in directly in the companies that produce them. There's a little more leverage typically to those prices, right? Where gold miners, for example, typically have a 2.5 to 3 times the overall volatility of gold prices. So if gold prices do well, you're probably going to do much better in individual gold mining names. But you have to pick the right ones as well. So if you don't have the expertise to understand which ones to pick, then you want to buy an overall ETF and you get broad diversification. If you have a very strong conviction, you could buy a leveraged ETF to the shares or the underlying gold price or commodity price, whatever you're looking at, and use it as a trade. But you wouldn't want to own those and hold them long term. Hope that helps.
Hi, Steve or Justin. I love your show and appreciate your advice.
I'm curious about what account would be best to trade under. I have a Roth IRA and individual trading account. Which one would be better for making trades and investments? Thank you.
Well, if you're trading a lot and you're creating short-term capital gains, then a tax-deferred account like a Roth IRA would be the best. If you're a buy and holder and you're typically not selling very often, then those type of investments are better in maybe taxable accounts because you're not creating taxable events very often. So depends on how much you trade. For most traders, a tax-deferred account is best.
Hi, I had a 401k from a previous employer that was automatically rolled over into an IRA. It's just in cash currently. And I'd like to move that over to a Schwab or a TD Ameritrade or something and just get a little experience day trading with that money, if possible. I've been playing with a little of my personal money in Robinhood accounts. I don't play with my 401k at all. Don't touch that at all. I max out the contribution. Is it possible to day trade with money that was formerly in a 401k? And am I going about this the right way to get experience? I'd love to hear your answer on the show. Thank you.
Well, there are sometimes rules around day trading in an IRA, especially if they're under $25,000. So typically look into that with what the broker's rules are on it. I definitely would move your money away from Robinhood. I don't think anybody should have their money in Robinhood anymore, especially with Schwab, TD, E-Trade, Fidelity all having commission-free trading. So I would try to consolidate your IRA and brokerage account into one firm. We use TD Ameritrade, but they're all pretty good. Just definitely make sure they're all SIPC insured and big. So definitely go with that route. Now, day trading, 99 out of 100 people who day trade fail. So your odds of failure are very, very high. If you're going to day trade, start with paper trading. Start making, you know, real live decisions. Don't look backwards and say, well, what if I did this? Say, okay, I'm going to pull the trigger right now. If I did that, my fill would probably be this. Put that down in a spreadsheet and then start paper trading. Okay, I would get out here. Put that down. And be honest with yourself as well. Be very, very honest with yourself. And there are actually even paper trading programs out there that you can use. So paper trade first. Find a strategy that you find works week after week, and frankly, month after month. I would paper trade for 6 months before you do any type of day trading.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461.